many of you. It was I felt very happy to be here and to meet you all again. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to come to Australia that often, but I do feel a very deep bond with Australia. In the early 80s, I used to come here quite frequently, and I developed deep friendship with many of the devotees here at that time. And often I think of those days, they're very fond memories of those days. And I also have a very profound impression of this country, the people of this country. And I do feel that people here are very nice, they are very receptive, very friendly, and Krishna consciousness movement has established a very deep root here. This movement had been growing very wonderfully, and I'm confident that this country will play a very significant role in re-spiritualizing this world. It's a massive work, but we all have to collectively work towards that. Srila Prabhupada gave us a very unique spiritual gift, which is very rare. Even in the Vedic culture, this Krishna consciousness was kept as a hidden secret. It was not revealed, it was not exposed so much. Only some rare fortunate souls had access to Krishna consciousness. It has been described that when one received the highest perfection of yoga, when one reached the stage of samadhi in yoga, then one used to become qualified to receive Krishna consciousness, Krishna bhakti. But that rare Krishna bhakti has been distributed without any discrimination, without any consideration of qualification, to anyone and everyone in this age. Although this age is most degraded, the age of Kali is most degraded age, but in this age, this Krishna consciousness, which is the most rare spiritual gift, even in the spiritual sky, not that everyone has access to spiritual process of Krishna Prem or Braja Prem. But Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has distributed it without any discrimination. That's why Mahaprabhu has been described as the Mahavadanya, the most munificent personality. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is very merciful. He is Kripa Maya, he is full of mercy. Yet, he did not display this kind of mercy previously, as he did appearing as Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So this Krishna Prem has been given by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu as a very special gift. for this, for the living entities of this age. Therefore he has been glorified as Namo Mahavadanaya Krishna Prema Pradayate. Vadanya means most munificent, most magnanimous. And he is Mahavadanya, the supreme manifestation of magnanimity. And how that magnanimous aspect of the Lord has been displayed here? Krishna Prema Pradayate. He is distributing Krishna Prema, love of Godhead, love of Krishna. This Krishna Prema literally means Braja Prema, the way the residents of Vrindavan had their loving relationship with Krishna. That has been given by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, which was otherwise not given. The same point has been clarified as Anarpita Charin Chirat. Anarpita means which was never given before. Arpan means to give, and Anarpita means that hasn't been given before. Chirat, forever, for a long, long time, it was not given. Now, in order to give that, Korunaya Abhutirna Kalo, he has appeared very mercifully in this age of Kali, Kalo, in the age of Kali. In one hand, the age of Kali is very degraded age, the most fallen age. People in this age are practically submerged in sinful activities. Kaler doshe nidhe rajan. Submerged in sinful activities. Unconsciously, everyone is being drawn into sinful activities. In one hand, in the age of Kali is so degraded, but Krishna, appearing as Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, has bestowed the greatest good fortune to the living entities of this age. Korunaya Avatirna Kalo. So that is the gift, the unique and unprecedented gift of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu distributed it all over India. But Mahaprabhu made a very wonderful prediction, an amazing prediction. Prithibite ache jato nagoradi gram sarvatra prachar hoibe mor nam. To every town and village throughout the world, in every town and village, this Krishna consciousness movement will spread. It was actually an impossible prediction, an inconceivable prediction. How could Krishna consciousness movement spread throughout the world in every town and village? But in the recent past we saw, although it appeared to be impossible, a prediction, but it happened. Srila Prabhupada came, and in a most amazing way, within a very short span of 10 years' time, this movement spread all over the world. is another inconceivable feat. Srila Prabhupada not only came and spread Krishna consciousness, but the way he did it is an amazing happening. A 70-year-old man goes to America without any resources, without any contact with anyone. He just goes there and starts this movement from the scratch. He did not have any resources. He did not have any patronage. He did not have anyone to support him in a most insignificant way even. He was just a lone 70-year-old man. He went to America and started this movement. And then we see an impossible phenomena unfolding. This movement just started to spread all over the world. No other spiritual movement has spread the way this Krishna consciousness movement has spread. If we look at Christianity, whatever Christianity is today is a result of 2000 years of preaching. Islam, about 1000 years of very, very intense endeavor to spread their mission. But this Krishna consciousness movement, Hare Krishna movement, spread all over the world in just 10 years' time. No other movement has ever spread the way this movement has. And this is just the beginning. There's no way of knowing how this movement is going to spread. And the destiny of this movement is clear as broad daylight. Why? Because the substance that this movement has is the most profound spiritual understanding. Most profound spiritual process. Like, often people take to their respective religion simply out of some sentimental reason or faith or compulsion. But this Krishna consciousness movement is founded on sound spiritual understanding and explanation. This Krishna consciousness movement is like Prabhupada used to say, like, if you have any question, I have the answer. If you have a question, I have the answer. Any question can be answered, but any question pertaining to spiritual subject matter, starting from the spirit soul all the way to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Like, in simple words, Prabhupada once mentioned, if you want to know about God, you can come to me. I can tell you what his name is, what he looks like, where he stays, what he does, and I can even give you his telephone number. So any question, any sincere question pertaining to the spiritual subject matter can be answered. How because the information has been received from the most bona fide and most authentic source. Krishna consciousness is a science. It's a subject that can be very systematically studied. It's a subject matter that can be very analytically analyzed and explained. This is something that can be experimentally verified. And that is what Krishna consciousness is. There is no room for blind faith. Some religions say that don't ask questions. Those questions are blasphemous. They don't even want to get into God's form. They accept that God has a form, but you are not supposed to ask about His form, how He looks like. That is considered to be blasphemy. Many a times they're told that don't ask this question, because since they don't have the answer, they forbid the questions. But that's not the case with Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada's point is, if you have a question, I have the answer. Ask any question. As a matter of fact, the devotees become excited when people ask intelligent questions, because that gives them a chance to speak on that subject matter and very systematically establish the authenticity of this knowledge. And the subject matter is, as I said, science. It's a science, yes, it's a science about the soul. It's a science about the spiritual reality, the spiritual nature. And just as a subject has to be systematically studied, following specific books under the guidance of qualified teachers, this process also has to be studied, following a specific syllabus under the guidance of qualified teachers. And when you do that, then yes, we become exponents in this science, in this subject matter. And where did you receive this knowledge? We receive the knowledge from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Originally, this knowledge was imparted by the Lord Himself, and that knowledge is flowing through a disciplic succession, spiritual master to disciple. Then, in course of time, the disciple becomes a spiritual master and imparts the knowledge unto his disciple. Then, in course of time, this disciple becomes a spiritual master and imparts the knowledge unto his disciple. And that's what constitutes the disciplic succession. And in Bhagavad Gita also, Krishna made the same point. He actually mentioned that this knowledge has been imparted originally by Himself. Imam vivashate yogam praktavan aham abhayam. I imparted this knowledge, I spoke this knowledge to Vivashvate, to Vivashvan, sun god. Proktavan, I spoke. And Vivashvan manavip praho. Then Vivashvan imparted this knowledge to his son Manu, manavip praho. Manorikshakuve abravit. And then Manu spoke this knowledge to Ikshvaku, his son. So Vivashvan's son is Manu, Manu's son is Ikshvaku. And from this Ikshvaku originated one royal dynasty, which is known as Suryavamsa. Suryavamsa, the Sun Dynasty. Sun Dynasty because this dynasty comes from Sun God. Vivashvan is the Sun God, then his son to Manu, Manu's son Ikshvaku. And Imam Vivashati Yogam Praptavan Aham Abhayam Vivashvan Manavipraho Manu Ikshvaku Vyabhuvit Evam Parampara Praptam. In this way, through a disciplic succession, Parampara Praptam Imam Rajarshayo Vidyu. Rajarshayo, Raja means king and Rishi means a saintly sage. So the kings in this dynasty were actually saintly sages. They were sages. But for the sake of benefiting the mankind, they assumed the role of a monarch. Actually, they were saintly sages. They would have been happy living in a forest, cultivating the spiritual science. But for the sake of benefiting others, they have accepted the responsibility of becoming a king. Although it may seem like being a king is so wonderful, it would be so nice to be a king, but actually it's really a hassle to be a king. There's so much undesirable responsibilities, so much burdens, so much anxiety, so much struggle, and oftentimes it ends in distress. When you look at the history, like, we can see that the kings were not really enjoying. The poor characters were suffering. Even if we look at Mahabharata, it's very painful to see these personalities, how they were actually suffering. When you go deep into Mahabharata and analyze or see those personalities, you can see, like, actually there was so much suffering, so much hurt, so much pain, so much anguish, so much agony. Just consider one simple incident, just try to consider that. Bhishma took a vow of lifelong celibacy because his father became enchanted by one lady, and the father of that girl told that the condition behind getting married or receiving this girl would be that her son has to be the successor to the throne. Now Bhishma was already the crown prince, Shantanu's elder son, the only son actually at that time, Bhishma, and very wonderful personality, valiant character, son of Mother Ganga, brought up in the heavenly planet. He studied under the tutelage of Brihaspati, the spiritual master of the demigods, and learned the warfare using weapons from Parashuram, the warrior incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Such a brilliant personality. And he was the crown prince, and Shantanu was deeply in love with his son. He was practically, he was the apple of his eye. And when Bhishma got this Satyavati, the lady who he fell in love with, her father said that if you want, I don't mind giving you my daughter, but only one condition, that her son has to be the successor to the throne. He said, how can that be? How can that be? That because I already have a son who is the successor to the throne. Then the father said, then forget about marrying my daughter. I'm sorry. So heartbroken, Shantanu went back to his palace. Bhishma noticed it, that his father looked very morose. So he asked him, but the father wouldn't say anything. Then from the charioteer, he found out what actually happened. And he asked the charioteer, can you please take me to that place? So he went and he approached the person, the father of the girl. And the father said, yes, I don't mind offering my daughter to your father, but I have a condition that her son has to be the successor to the throne. Then he said, okay, her son will become the successor to the throne and I'll forgo my right over the throne. Then the Dhivar Raj, the king of the fishermen, the father of the girl, said, yeah, that's very nice. But what about your children? You may forgo your right over the kingdom, but your children may start to fight over the right over the kingdom. Then he said, okay, in that case I won't get married. And he accepted the lifelong celibacy, a vow of lifelong celibacy. So Satyavati got married to Shantanu. And in course of time, two sons were born, Chitrangad and Vichitravirja. But both the sons died prematurely. Chitrangad died fighting with a Gandharva whose name also was Chitrangad, and Vichitravirja died of tuberculosis. And there was nobody as a successor to the throne. Bhishma is the only person, but he denounced his right over the kingdom. He took a vow that he is not going to accept the kingdom. So although Bhishma is there, but still the kingdom doesn't have a king. And not only that, there is no successor to the dynasty. And the same Satyavati, for whose sake Bhishma had to take the vow of lifelong celibacy, Satyavati was herself asking Bhishma, now please get married. Please get married. I am telling you, for my sake you took that vow, and I am telling you to get married. Bhishma said, no, it's not a matter of your telling or not. It's a matter of my vow. I took a vow that I'm not going to get married. So I'm not going to break that promise. Now can you imagine, you know, like the situation at that time in the kingdom? Two sons died. So much struggle to establish her sons to the throne, but both are dead. Now what happens, when you are dead? Can you claim? Can you have any claim over anything in this material nature? So this is how futile our endeavors in the material nature is. And the result is disappointment, suffering, and pain. When you come to that chapter, that part in Mahabharata, you can see that it was such an ominous situation in the kingdom, so much uncertainty. Not only the son died, but there is no successor to the throne. the one of the most glorious dynasty, but now it's gone, it's broken. There's no possibility of continuity of this dynasty. Bhishma is there, but in spite of being there, he is not there. One of the most glorious, one of the most valiant heroes, but he's deprived of his own kingdom. Although he is there, but he doesn't have any right over the kingdom. He himself has refused, denied himself of that right. And then Vasudev was requested to procreate in the womb of Vichitravirya's wife. And this is a Vedic custom. When the brother dies without children, then the brother of the husband can procreate in the womb, or rather could procreate in the womb of the sister-in-law. But that custom has been rejected, forbidden in the age of Kali. Other ages this custom was prevalent, authorized, but not in the age of Kali. Five things have been forbidden in the age of Kali: Ashwamedham, Gavalabdham, Sanyasa Palapautrikam, Devarena Sutatpatti, Kalo Pancha Vivarjayat. The horse sacrifice, Ashwamedh, Gomedh, Gavalabdham, cow sacrifice, and Sanyas, accepting the renounced order of life. Palapoitrikam, offering meat in the Shraddha ceremony of the forefathers. And Devarena Sutatpatti, procreating through the brother-in-law. These five things have been forbidden. Anyway, Vasudev was Vichitravirya's half-brother. Through Parasar Muni, Satyavati received Vasudev previous to getting married to Shantanu. So she told Bhishma about that, and then Bhishma suggested, then asked him to come and procreate in the womb of the wives of Vichitravirya, Ambika and Ambalika. And two sons were born, Dhritarashtra and Pandu. Dhritarashtra was blind. So even though he was the elder brother, he couldn't ascend the throne. He couldn't become the king. And Pandu also, he was cursed that if he ever united with his wife, he would immediately die. So in this way we can see Mahabharata is a series of undesirable and agonizing anecdotes, happenings. And then finally the two branches of cousins in the same family, they started to fight. And the worst battle in the world was fought in the battlefield of Kurukshetra. So this way we can see that this, although it seems that the kings are enjoying so much, or when one becomes a king, he has so much opportunity to enjoy. But the reality is very different. these Kshatriya kings, they had some moments of joy, but most of the times it was struggle. They would go to a battlefield in total uncertainty. When a Kshatriya warrior would go out to a battle, the family members knew that he may come back or may not come back. And many a times they didn't come back. And this point has been established in Bhagavad Gita. In the mode of passion, the activities in the mode of passion causes distress. Activities in the mode of passion will cause distress. So these are the activities in the mode of passion. Therefore, the intelligent class of people, wise people, don't get involved in activities in the mode of passion. They rather stay in the mode of goodness. And the mode of goodness actually brings real joy, not apparent joy, but substantial joy. The so-called joy in the mode of passion is illusory. It's apparent. It appears that there will be some enjoyment, but the reality is very, very different. But in the mode of goodness, they simply stand aside and just become absorbed in spiritual activities. And that involvement in the spiritual activity brings the real joy. The source of real happiness, the happiness that is everlasting, the happiness that is ever increasing, the happiness that inundates the heart with a feeling of ecstasy, that is available only through spiritual indulgence, not from anything else. Materialistic involvement can never give us the everlasting joy. They may give us some temporary pleasure, but that is not what heart is hankering for. This temporary pleasure come and go. In the world of suffering, when the suffering is reduced to some extent, we call it pleasure. We call it happiness. But that's not what our heart is hankering for. Our heart is hankering for something that is everlasting, that's forever. And that can be achieved only through being engaged in serving the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Does anybody have any question or comment? If you have a question, as I mentioned, that spiritual subject matter is actually discussed through questions and answers. Often we do speak on the topic, but it would be better even if it can be practically reciprocated through questions and answers. Any question? Yes?
I've just had a baby, and he's 3 months old, and I love him so much, and I'm so worried about him for, and I don't know how to reach that point where I detach from him because I love him so much. Is he part of the material world that I have to?